Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
He's sitting on the couch at home alone. He turns on cable access, and bam, there is the Dark Secrets documentary about Bohemian Grove. And I really think that, you know, people deal with grief in a lot of different ways. Sometimes they might turn to drugs or alcohol or some sort of unhealthy activity. And for Richard, Alex Jones was like his new escapism or way he was coping with stuff. So he sees this documentary and he believes it very literally. And he's like, no way am I going to let these people sacrifice children to this Moloch owl statue. So he starts planning this costume raid where he, you know, gets a bunch of weapons, puts together this Phantom Patriot costume, and heads up towards the Bohemian Grove.
Every year, some of the world's most powerful men descend upon Sonoma County, California, to a retreat spot known as the Bohemian Grove. There, they dress in black robes, and under the night sky and the pagan moon, they commit
child sacrifices to the ancient Babylonian owl god Moloch.
This strange and sinister ritual is known as the cremation of care. Or at least that's what conspiracy theorist Alex Jones told his followers when he snuck into the grove and captured footage of the ritual. One of Alex Jones' many followers could not stand by as the shadowy satanic elites committed heinous acts against innocent children. Enter the mild-mannered Richard McCaslin. By day, a Batman stunt performer at a Six Flags amusement park. But by night, he dons a superhero costume and a skull mask as
the Phantom Patriot.
And on January 19th, 2002, the Phantom Patriot attempted a raid on Bohemian Grove. Joining us on this edition of the program is T. Krulos, author of the new book, American Madness: The Story of the Phantom Patriot and How Conspiracy Theories Hijacked American Consciousness. T. will not only tell us the entire story of the tragic figure known as Richard McCaslin, aka the Phantom Patriot. And yes, this is the Phantom Patriot upon which the Les Claypool song of the same name was based. But I digress. T is going to tell us the whole story and, in addition, explain how McCaslin's story is something of a prelude to the moment we find ourselves in today, where conspiracy is all the rage, often in a very dangerous way, as evidenced by, for example, the arson of Comet Ping Pong by a Pizzagate truther who believed the restaurant was being used for child sexual slavery by high-level Democrats like Hillary Clinton. And, of course, the recent child kidnapping by a mother who had come to believe in QAnon. It turns out the Phantom Patriot story, in addition to being a tragic one, is also rather timely. And now, on to the conversation with T. Krulos, author of American Madness, the story of the Phantom Patriot and how conspiracy theory hijacked American consciousness. Welcome to Parallax Views, T. Krulos, author of the new Feral House book. I'm holding it right in my hands. American Madness, the story of the Phantom Patriot and how conspiracy theories hijacked American consciousness. I do not know where to begin with this book because it covers the Phantom Patriot, who we're going to talk a lot about, but it also covers how conspiracy theory has become the new black, as some of my friends say. You know, it's popular as all get out now. How did you get into writing a book about conspiracy theories?
Well, it really started with Richard McCaslin, who was a conspiracy theorist who designed his own superhero persona, the Phantom Patriot. Now, before I was in contact with him, I had some interest in conspiracy theory. When I was younger, I liked to read a lot of books about UFO cases, which, of course, most UFO stories are also a story of government conspiracy of some kind. And I was interested in the JFK assassination. And so I wasn't, you know, I would read about it here and there when I encountered it. I started working on my first book, which is titled Heroes in the Night, around 2009, 2010. That book is about a kind of strange subculture of people who adopt their own superhero personas. And some of them actually try to fight crime. Others do sort of a charitable type of thing.
So it's a real life version of the movie Kick-Ass, in other words.
Yes, yes. And actually, if you've seen Kick-Ass, you know, it's very much inspired by real life superheroes. So I started working on a blog about this, which was really great because it helped me connect to this subculture or social movement. And one day I get a message from Richard, and he said, you know, I found your blog and I want to talk to you because I'm a real life superhero. And I'm actually, you know, there was this incident in 2002 where I started a fire inside of the Bohemian Grove. And I had never heard of this place. And I was like, what is this guy talking about? So, you know, I immediately like went to Wikipedia and searched Bohemian Grove and just like fell into, you know, the cliche thing to say. I fell into a rabbit hole. Just reading about the Bohemian Grove and trying to figure out what this place was. And once I had sort of an idea, I responded to Richard and I said, yeah, I'm interested to talk to you. Like, this is seems like a interesting story. And it just went from there. I ended up meeting Richard three times in person, and I corresponded with him for about 8 years. And along the way was just researching a lot of the stuff he was telling me. You know, and sometimes I would find stuff that he told me had a grain of truth to it. Sometimes it was just completely off the wall. And sometimes I was like, all right, he's kind of right about this. So it was really kind of a struggle to figure out what is real and what is exaggerated. And I found out quite a bit about people who had influenced his thinking a lot. And it just evolved into the story that leads up to, you know, this really crazy year that we're having, where conspiracy theory has just exploded and it's in the news all the time.
I wanted to touch on something briefly before we really dive into the book. You know, with a lot of these books that cover eccentrics, I think it becomes a sort of like, oh, look at these like funny haha weirdos. And I think it becomes like a thing where people can sort of mock outsiders. I don't get the impression that's what you were trying to do with this book.
No, never. That's not my style at all. I consider myself to be kind of a strange person. So I'm not really in a position to look down on people and call them weird. And especially when I first started working on the real life superhero book, there were a lot of media pieces that were just mean-spirited, condescending, you know, kind of made these stereotypes about these people without bothering to try to get to know them at all.
Well, why would that be? I mean, my understanding of the real life superheroes, I mean, it's weird. They walk around as superheroes, but I don't think they do anyone harm, and they just do like neighborhood watch type stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, overall, there's been a couple of them who have definitely found themselves in, like you say, a kick-ass situation. But I didn't want to make fun of them. I think that there's some humorous things about them, but I wanted to kind of laugh with them and not at them. I think that's really been my approach for all of my writing is I think these people are interesting, and I think it would be a very boring book if you focus on just making fun of people, you know?
Now, before we get into McCaslin, let's talk about Bohemian Grove. Now, you said he went on a raid in Bohemian Grove, but before we get to the raid, I'm going to have listeners that haven't seen that insane Alex Jones documentary, Dark Secrets Inside Bohemian Grove. So what is Bohemian Grove and the Bohemian Club for my listeners that may be unfamiliar?
Yes, it's really a fascinating story, I think. What happened was in the days when San Francisco was developing as a city, there was a small group of writers and actors and artists who wanted to form a club to help develop the arts in San Francisco. You know, it's still kind of the Wild West out there at this point. So they start the Bohemian Club. But what they find is, you know, after a few years, that they don't have, this is a classic problem, they don't have money to support this organization.
Starving artists.
Right, exactly. It's a classic story. So they start inviting guys who are bankers and businessmen into the club. And sort of the exchanges, they get to look cool because they're supporting the arts, and the Bohemian Club gets their money. About 5 or 6 years after the club starts, one of their members decides he's going to move to the East Coast. So they have a party out in the woods where they get drunk and, you know, talk and have a bonfire. It's more like a camping trip. They have such a good time that they're like, we should do this every July. So they start buying up property in Northern California in the Redwood Forest. And it grows and grows. They have these nice cabins, and they have a 2-week celebration there every July. And some of the world's most wealthy and powerful men are members, including several U.S. presidents.
Nixon, Reagan, I think, was there at one point. Yeah.
Yeah, Nixon and Reagan, for sure. The Bush family, all are members.
And, even some celebrities, I hear, right? Isn't Conan O'Brien, he was there at one point, the Grateful Dead.
Yes. So there's members, but they all bring in special guests. And because they have so much money, they can really afford to fly anyone into there. So yeah, a lot of famous entertainers, like you mentioned, Conan O'Brien was a guest, like Clint, the club member.
So this gathering of men happens there, and conspiracy theorists really love the story because first, all of these powerful men are in this secluded retreat, and the press is not allowed in there at all. People who aren't members aren't allowed in there. It's a men-only club. So they're meeting at the secret club, and to kick off their summer celebration, they have this very bizarre ritual that they do in front of a statue of a giant owl, a 40-foot tall statue of an owl. And they dress in these monk robes and are carrying torches, and they have this very strange, like, poetic speech that they give. And then they burn an effigy at the foot of this owl statue. And this effigy is supposed to represent their worldly cares. It's called dull care. So what they're doing is they're symbolically burning all the stuff that they hate in the real world that's annoying, a headache. And then when they burn this, then they're free to party in the woods. And they get drunk, and they have music. They have special plays that are performed just for the Bohemian Grove. And they network and schmooze with each other and go fishing, stuff like that.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the plays. I didn't know about the plays before, but I guess apparently since it's a men's only club, they do plays with female characters, which means a lot of the the guys involved when they're playing female characters, they're going in drag and doing the can-can dance and whatnot.
Yeah, they have two productions that they do. One is a really big production called the Grove Play. And this is something classy, usually, you know, like a Shakespeare type of play, something like that. And it's a big production. They have hundreds of people in it. But then they have a performance called the Low Jinx. And this is kind of a raunchy vaudeville performance. And like you say, some of the world's most powerful men will dress up like a rockette and drag and do a can-can dance, which is probably one of the reasons they don't allow photography in the Grove, except for in the individual camps.
Now, it's interesting, too. You mentioned the networking aspect. And, you know, I think it's easy to think of Bohemian Grove either as, you know, a massive conspiracy of satanic elites, as Alex Jones would say, or to look at it as, oh, my God, it's a bunch of, you know, weird Republicans, you know, getting down with their kinkier side, as I think Bill Clinton once said to someone.
Right.
But there is, I think, an issue that can arise out of something like Bohemian Grove in the sense that although within their roles, you know, politics is supposed to be off limits, it can actually be used as a network, you know, and if you network with, you know, the right powerful people, it can create advantages for you. And there's actually some very serious people who have covered Bohemian Grove in that sense. Like G. William Domhoff, and also the Bohemian Grove Action Network. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. This is one of my favorite parts of the story of the Bohemian Grove, too. You know, the reason that we know a lot of these details about the Grove is that over the decades, there's been several people who have infiltrated into the Grove undercover. So one of the biggest assets for making this happen is the Bohemian Grove Action Network, which was started by a activist named Mary Moore. And she would organize protests outside of the front gate of the Bohemian Grove on the opening day of the summer encampment. So, you know, all these rich, powerful men are driving into this country lane into the Grove. And there's a group of activists there holding up signs, trying to get their attention about different issues, you know, about, you know, anti-war messages, environmental messages, stuff like that. But Bohemian Grove Action Network also would make friends with employees there. to keep these rich men satisfied, as you can imagine, they need a very large staff of waiters and, you know, people to do custodial work and stuff like that.
And I'm assuming those employees can get very disgruntled sometimes.
Yes, exactly. I'm sure these guys are very demanding. So they would sneak out guest lists, production programs, you know, any sort of material that was around the Grove that they thought might be useful in revealing who some of the membership to the club was. So Bohemian Grove Action Network developed this sort of system of getting material out, and then also occasionally sneaking a journalist in through one of the service entrances. One of my favorite, and it was really great because I got to interview Mary Moore on the phone to talk to her.
She's the head of the network, right?
Yes. Yeah. And I also got to speak to Philip Weiss.
Of Mondo Weiss. I'm very familiar with Philip. I didn't even know that he did a piece on Bohemian Grove until reading this. And then I was like, oh my God, Philip Weiss, the same one?
Yes. He did a great, great piece. This cracks me up so much. He would walk through the service entrance carrying a copy of the Wall Street Journal under one arm and an empty martini glass. So he looked like, you know, he was just one of the Grove members. For their summer encampment, they usually have a couple thousand people there. So, you know, you can blend in if you look like you belong there.
If you look like your typical middle-aged white man.
Right. Yeah. One of the funny things, I don't think I mentioned this in the book, Philip was like, hey, you should go and sneak in. I was like, I don't think I can. I don't think I'd be able to do it. They just would think I look suspicious. But he did do it, and he was able to speak to Ronald Reagan. He confirmed a rumor that Nixon and Reagan were hanging out at the Bohemian Grove, and talking about which one of them would run for president first, you know, and they, of course, decided that Nixon would run first.
You know, what's funny about that? Well, go on. Finish what you were going to say.
Oh, I was just saying, and he got to, you know, he eavesdropped on Henry Kissinger and got to see the cremation of care ceremony. And he was in and out of there for about a week. And in addition to him, there's been several people over the years who have had varying degrees of success sneaking in there undercover.
I was going to say, since you mentioned the Nixon and Reagan rumor, that's going to surprise some people, because a lot of people have heard the story of Richard Nixon saying some very politically incorrect things about the Bohemian Grove, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, he seemed to have two different mindsets about it. As I talked about in this chapter, he said that he gave one of the greatest speeches of his life at the Bohemian Grove, because they have daily what are called lakeside talks. So near the statue of an owl, every day there's a couple of speeches from, you know, the head of the CIA, astronauts, celebrities, politicians. So Nixon says he gave one of the greatest speeches of his life at the Grove, and it really energized his presidential campaign. But he also was caught in his famous, you know, Nixon tapes saying that there was a bunch of homosexuals that went to the Grove and it's just the worst thing you've ever seen, you know?
So in regards to the Grove, how does it become sort of conspiracy central? Let's talk about the Alex Jones documentary, in other words.
Yes. So that was probably the last successful infiltration. After this, they really kind of beefed security up, I think, quite a bit. Well, after Jones and after Richard, which I'm sure we'll talk about too. But in 2000, Alex Jones, who is still not really well known at this point, he's just kind of starting to get his career off the ground. And he's doing a lot of low budget documentaries at this point. And
Police State 2000.
Yeah, that's right.
Stuff like that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Great stuff. And he's showing them on cable access and then also selling, you know, VHS or DVDs of these documentaries. So him and his associates sneak into the Bohemian Grove in 2000 on the opening night of the summer encampment. And his associate, who's named Mike Hansen, had a camera hidden inside of a duffel bag. So they sneak in there. They're very nervous. They're walking around, like, filming this really shaky footage of stuff in the grove. And then at night, they sneak in with the crowd to the cremation of care ceremony, and they record the whole ritual. It is the first time anyone has gotten video of this thing. And then he cuts it together into a documentary called Dark Secrets. And, you know, he has a very heavy conspiracy spin on what he's seen. And he loves to do this thing where he sort of asks these rhetorical questions or questions that are like, who knows? This might not be just an effigy. It could be a real person. And, adds all these elements to it, saying that this is a satanic ritual and that, you know, they're sacrificing people out here and then plotting to how they're going to destroy the world.
It's the Illuminati and the Freemasons.
Right. And this documentary, you know, it slowly starts to get out there and people see it. And also I should mention, at the same time Alex Jones sneaks in.
I was going to say John Ronson.
Yeah. He was profiling Alex Jones. And for some reason, I think Alex Jones got suspicious of him or something and snuck in without him. But he also snuck in that same night and actually encountered him in the grove. But he did it just by walking through the front gate with somebody who knew about it. Just looked confident and walked in.
I mean, the British accent probably helps. It makes him seem more sophisticated.
Yeah. So he wrote a great chapter about his experience sneaking in there, and I think that I trust his observations a lot more than I do Alex Jones, is what I'll say.
Because well, it's Ronson funny. All, go on, go on.
But Ronson and everyone else who snuck in there besides Alex Jones, they all pretty much agree on what they saw in there, which is a bunch of grown men kind of reliving their college days, getting drunk, making crude jokes, you know, and yeah, networking, not plotting to destroy the world networking, but very much like that Nixon and Reagan story where they kind of talk about business a little bit here and there, but it's not like some satanic playground where live people are being burnt in front of an owl and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's interesting with the networking thing because I've read Peter Phillips' leaked dissertation on the subject, A Relative Advantage, and G. William Domhoff, who you mentioned in the book. And I'm like, you know, there is something unequal about that, right? Like you're able to network at places like Bohemian Grove. Other people don't have those networking opportunities, as we'll learn later, I think, with Richard McCaslin. But I wanted to ask you one more question about the grove, and that's I'm assuming for this book you've read Dark Secrets, or you've seen the movie, the documentary Dark Secrets inside Bohemian Grove. The thing that fascinates me about it is I often have wondered if anyone actually watches the whole documentary. This is pretty long. I think it's like two and a half hours, and most people just like the climax, you know, that's like the money shot of the movie, you know, oh, we're going to show you the cremation of care ritual. But I was watching it with my dad one time in my like teens, because I went through like a conspiracy phase. I think every like white male goes through like a conspiratorial libertarian phase when they're younger. And my dad was like saying, as Alex and Mike Hansen are walking around in the daylight, you know, the people at this place, they just look like normal dudes and hillbillies. It doesn't really look that frightening, even in the movie. Until that cremation of care, which I guess comes off as weird, but I just view it as, you know, fraternal hijinks.
Right. Yeah, it's similar. Like Skull and Bones is a famous Yale fraternity, and they have some creepy kooky ritual as well. It's just dramatic, you know. Alex Jones, that documentary is so long and so slow moving and could be edited down to, you know, half the length for sure.
And it does a lot of damage to the Bohemian Grove Action Network, which I actually like those people. They're completely wrong to protest it. I don't know. To me, it's like, I think they're a lot more level-headed about what they're doing.
Yeah, and they after this documentary came out, they were very annoyed because people would kind of ask them about, like, the child sacrificing rituals and stuff like that. And they're like, you know, what we're upset about is that this group of men meets, they have these private lakeside talks where they talk about policy that affects everyone. And the people aren't privy to that. You know, it's an elite club of these men only club, you know. Jones, one of the funniest things in that documentary, by the way, is Jones gets on a shuttle truck going into the Grove, him and Mike Hansen. And he asked someone sitting across from him, where do we get the robes from? Meaning like the monk robes, you know? And they're like, who are you? It's a strange documentary, and it did a lot of damage, like you say, as far as people believing it to be true, you know?
So that brings us to Richard McCaslin, who just, yeah. I think it was what, 2002. I think that's like a year after the Dark Secrets documentary came out. He does a raid on the Grove. But before we get into the raid itself, I guess we have to explain who Richard McCaslin, otherwise known as the Phantom Patriot, was. Yeah. Who is Richard?
So I get this email from Richard. I read about the Bohemian Grove. And I'm like, I'm interested in the story. I don't know where this is going, but I'm interested to talk to this guy. So I reply to him, and he sends me this package that has a very long letter talking about himself. It has a homemade comic book that he drew while in prison that at least part of it is autobiographical about his raid into the Bohemian Grove. And I ended up interviewing him a lot, and I slowly pieced together his life story. So, you know, he grew up as an only child. He became very fascinated with comic books when he was young, and that was really his escapism, was he just loved reading comic books, watching comic book-inspired TV shows, stuff like that. And he has a strong desire to become a comic book superhero. One thing he found is there's this very interesting self-published book that was published in 1980 called How to Be a Superhero. And it's sort of like a guidebook, you know, how to make a costume, what types of martial arts you should study to be a superhero. So he gets really into this idea. He begins making his own costumes. He says that he joined the Marines after high school because he viewed that as like a superhero training school, basically, right? You learn how to do some basic combat and weapons training. After he gets out of the Marines, he decides that he's going to pursue a Hollywood dream, and he goes to a very quirky stunt school in California, led by an interesting character named Kim Kahana. And he does this stuntman training. But he finds that he's not really finding work after that. One of the reasons was he didn't, for some reason, join the stuntman union.
He also is not, you know, we were talking about networking earlier. He is not the greatest at networking. He's kind of a shy, awkward guy.
Yes, yes. He met one of his few friends that he was friends with for life was someone he met at the stuntman school named Lon. And Lon became a friend to him, and that's something he said when I interviewed Lon, that he had a lot of trouble networking, which is, especially in Hollywood, that's what you gotta do, like, basically all the time. You gotta be out there networking, trying to sell yourself, and Richard just wasn't really good at that. So he just kind of drifted around. He went back home. He was from Zanesville, Ohio, is where he grew up and where his parents live. He went back to Zanesville for a while. Then Lon actually told him that they're hiring stunt people down in Houston at Six Flags for their Batman stunt show.
You know, and he loved the Caped Crusader, as I understand it.
one of his favorite characters of all time was Batman. So this was really a dream for him. He got to go down to Houston, and, you know, he did this. He was Batman in the stunt show for one of the stunts, and, you know, did that every day, a few times a day. And he also found a part-time job as a delivery driver. So when he wasn't doing the stuntman stuff, he was working as a delivery driver. So for a moment there, I think his life was going good. But then the rug sort of gets pulled out from under him. Both of his parents die relatively close to each other. And that's very, very traumatizing for him. He's very close to his mother. He had a bad relationship with his father until later in his life. Their relationship improved a bit.
I wanted to mention something real quick here. And I don't want to like psychoanalyze Richard too much, but since we mentioned his parents, it's kind of an unusual upbringing, I guess, in some ways, in that, you know, the dad really did not want to get married. He tried not to go through with the marriage on wedding night, did not get along well with Richard. I think he hit him, right?
He hit him. He told them that he had wished that he hadn't been born because he was just a burden to them. So some very angry, nasty stuff.
And on the other hand of that, on the other hand, you have the mother who sort of comes under the sway, I guess, of TV holy rollers or televangelists, which is why they didn't want him reading comic books as a kid, apparently, or superhero comics. They wanted him to read the Christian Archie comics.
right. The Christian superhero comics. She was, they were very religious. They watched a lot of TV. He loved his mom a lot because she helped him make costumes. That's really where his love of, where his love of costume making comes from, is his mother was starting to make him costumes when he was very young. She finally made him a Batman costume when he was like 7 or 8 years old. And like I said, he was an only child. So this was all the family he had, really.
I was going to say in that regard, it's funny you mentioned a lot of TV in the household, because as I was reading your book, and as I was watching some of the very creative videos that Richard made, the Phantom Patriot retro cinema shows that he did, you can tell that this dude was basically a real life equivalent of Jim Carrey's character in Cable Guy. Like, that's basically who he is. And I mean that in the nicest way possible.
Yeah. No, that's a good comparison. Yeah. The death of his parents hits him very hard. He's also really struggling to find employment that's meaningful. And it took me a while to find this out. He had a very unhealthy idea that a country music star was going to fall in love with him. And, you know, her name's Shelley Wright.
Single white female.
Right. Hit song. I was not familiar with her music until Richard told me about her. But, you know, he's going through this emotional pain. He's got this crush on Shelley Wright. And he sees that she's doing a charity event where one of the things you can bid on is a dinner date with Shelley Wright. And he's like, all right, I'm driving there. I'm driving to Nashville, and I'm going to go to this charity event. So this is a good point to say that after Richard's parents died, he got a very large inheritance, almost $700,000. So he had all this money, but he didn't have any happiness, you know? He didn't have a relationship. He didn't really have a job. He was struggling with some of his friendships. He didn't have family. So he just had like this broken heart and way more money than he even knew how to spend. So he goes to this charity event and he wins the dinner date auction by throwing down $14,500. He goes on this, it sounds kind of awkward, dinner date with Shelley Wright and her publicist, and her fan club manager. And, she, you know, doesn't have a romantic interest in him. And that is very hard for him to, deal with as well.
Do you think deep down he knew? Because at points in the book, it seems like he keeps tricking himself into believing things like, oh, she offered me a role as an extra in her music video. You know, I could tell she was interested. I feel like sometimes he may know better, but he wants to believe.
Yes. He wrote his account of this dinner date. It was 21 pages long. And he sent me a copy of this firsthand account, and just reading through it, I was like, oh, dude, you're really trying to trick yourself into something that didn't happen. So, you know, he's unsuccessful with this. He is even more heartbroken. He decides to move to Austin, Texas.
Of Alex Jones.
Yes, exactly. He's sitting on the couch at home alone. He turns on cable access, and bam, there is the Dark Secrets documentary about Bohemian Grove. And I really think that, you know, people deal with grief in a lot of different ways. Sometimes they might turn to drugs or alcohol or some sort of unhealthy activity. And for Richard, Alex Jones was like his new escapism or way he was coping with stuff. So he sees this documentary and he believes it very literally. And he's like, no way am I going to let these people sacrifice children to this Moloch owl statue. So he starts planning this costume raid where he, you know, gets a bunch of weapons, puts together this Phantom Patriot costume, and heads up towards Bohemian Grove.
Now, there's an interesting side note to all of this. You know, there's been people like Alex Jones before, right? Yeah. One of the people you mentioned is a guy by the name of William Cooper, yes, who had his own show called The Hour of the Time. And it has one of the greatest intros of all time with the trains going, and it's very apocalyptic.
Yes.
And people should look that up because it's a master stroke of creative paranoia. But, you know, it's known that apparently Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, who were behind the Oklahoma City bombing, actually went to visit William Cooper.
Yeah.
And William Cooper sort of like wrote them off and was like, eh, go away. And then the Oklahoma City bombing happens, right? What's interesting to me is something similar happens with Alex Jones. He apparently meets Richard McCaslin. Is that true?
Yeah, it's very, very similar. Like you mentioned, McVeigh and Nichols stopped by Cooper's office. You know, and he's working on, he had a newspaper that he published sometimes. And they had a chat with him, and then they were on their way. And that's exactly what happened. McCaslin decides he's going to do this Bohemian Grove raid. And before he leaves town, he stops by the cable access station and has a brief conversation with Alex Jones. He doesn't tell him that he's going to be doing this because he doesn't want to incriminate him by having that knowledge. But he said he just, you know, wanted to talk to him face to face. So they had a brief conversation, and Alex Jones excuses himself. Richard thought, I think that maybe he just had to go to the bathroom or something like that. But Richard thinks that he's spooked out Alex Jones.
You know what I was thinking when I read that? I was thinking to myself, maybe Alex Jones just wanted to get away from him. Yeah. I've heard stories about Alex Jones from people that have worked in the radio stations around him that, like, in after he's done with the show, he doesn't want to talk like politics and stuff. I think he's carny in a lot of ways. I think he believes some stuff, but part of me was like, I bet you he was trying to get away from him and that Richard could tell, but Richard created something in his head where he's like, oh yeah, he's just worried that, you know, I'm an FBI agent.
Yeah. And that's Alex Jones then is the last person that he really talks to before he's arrested.
It's interesting too, because, you know, I'm sure people have said to you, oh, why would you cover this guy? He seems dumb and a kook. But he's actually pretty smart in a way, because he doesn't tell anyone he's going to do this. And also, he seems to plan it out pretty damn well, actually.
Yeah, yeah. It didn't go quite as he thought it would, but, you know, there was a plan. This was what really kind of made me go, what is going on with this story? Because his arsenal that he carried in there included, you know, a semi-automatic rifle, a ninja sword, a crossbow, and a smoke bomb launcher. So I was like, wow, this guy was ready for some comic book style combat, I guess.
And he goes in there on January 19th, 2002. Mm-hmm. And this for me is like the centerpiece of the book. Set the scene for us a little bit here, right? This is dramatic.
It's a very dramatic story. It's very exciting. He sneaks into the Bohemian Grove at night because he thinks that they just casually do satanic rituals there all the time.
Even though the real ceremony and the hijinks is in the summer.
In July. But he thinks that they do them there consistently. And then he found something on the internet, and this is why the internet is such a problem. He finds something on the internet that suggests that January 20th is some sort of satanic holiday. And I looked and I found this thing kind of circulating on Christian sites, and it seems like some bogus thing that was created during the satanic panic.
And we should also mention, how does he get directions to Bohemian Grove? It's through Alex Jones's documentary, Dark Secrets Inside Bohemian Grove, where he tells the viewer, this is how you get there.
That is the end of the documentary, is Alex Jones standing on the road to the Bohemian Grove, giving detailed driving instructions about how a person can get there. And it's so funny because after this raid, Alex Jones is like, oh my gosh, this is so crazy. Who would do something like that? It's like, well, you gave someone a motivation and a direct way to get there, to the secret place. So Richard gets there. He sneaks into the woods at night, but it's very dark in the Redwood Forest because the trees are so tall. And it was cloudy, so there was no moonlight.
It's like a maze in there, too, from my understanding. I mean,
it's just a huge – it's 2,700 acres.
It's like something – I just imagine it being like a – you know, like the Evil Dead movie. Like, I'd be scared to go into the Grove at night. It's just – like, not even because of the weird rituals they do there, but because, you know, it's just – it's a creepy forest at night.
Yeah. So he gets lost. His flashlight runs out of batteries, and he breaks into a cabin, one of these wealthy men's cabins. I tried to find out, by the way, what camp it was in, but he didn't remember at all, and I didn't find any information on it. He stays overnight in one of these cabins. I mean, he's awake the whole night, pretty much. And then at sunrise, he starts moving through the grove.
He's in full costume, right?
Yes. Full,
so what is the costume? Is if people can see the video version, he's dressed up in like a skull mask. He is like ready and rearing to go with an assault rifle. So I want to put that out there.
Go
on.
Walking through the grove, he finally finds his enemy, the Great Owl of Bohemia, which is the statue. He's very disappointed because he thought that it was made out of wood, like a carved redwood, and that he would be able to burn it. It was one of his major goals going in. He wanted to burn this owl down. But it's made out of, like, concrete, you know. So he's
upset about that. And then,
and this like, is well, at I'm sunrise, here. Right?
Yeah, right okay. at sunrise. He's like, well, I got to do something while I'm here. So he goes into a nearby mess hall where, you know, all the men have their dinner, and he lights it on fire. The fire is put out pretty quickly because it has, you know, sprinkler system, and an alarm goes off. So now the grove isn't completely empty. They always have a security person there year round. They usually have a maintenance person that's on the property that just, you know, maintains the property. So this alarm goes off and he's like, all right, I need to get out of here now. And so as he's walking out, he encounters the security guard, who's very freaked out to see a man in a skull mask with a gun walking around. So they call 911 and Richard, almost gets to his truck. But right before he does, squad cars pull up and four California Highway Patrol and the local Sonoma County Sheriff's Department, both show up and they have an armed standoff.
And I want to butt in here real quick, because what I found fascinating is that when the guards see him, he's just confidently like striding through, you know, like Mr. Superhero basically. Yeah. And then the standoff with the police is even weirder, because it sounds like the police were like, this dude has an assault rifle. He's wearing a skull mask. They don't know what to think. And he's pointing the rifle right at them. Go on from there.
Yeah. And he's kind of hiding behind a tree and deciding what he's going to do. This is a real part of the story where it could have gone very differently, because he's thinking that, and I think that maybe from what he told me, that he's looking for a suicide by cop, you know? So I think that he was really weighing his option of either being shot dead or surrendering. And that was a hard decision for him. Eventually, he decides he's going to surrender. So he, you know, walks out into the middle of the street and puts his gun down and then gets down on the ground and they arrest him.
It's interesting, too, with the security guards. Doesn't he wave at a security guard at one point?
Yeah. Yes. He saw the security guard, and the security guard had a walkie-talkie in his hand, which he thought was a gun. So he, drew on him. And then when he saw it was a walkie-talkie, he put his gun down and he just waved and kept walking.
Now the police, what was their experience of this? Because it sounds like Richard almost was like calm through all of this, whereas the police are like, you know, about to shit their pants.
Yes, they're freaked out. Sonoma County is pretty peaceful, you know, it's mostly just redwood forest and small little towns spread out. So they had never dealt like with anything like that in their life. So it was very frightening and weird for them. One of the great things I was able to read was, Richard's friend Lon had gotten the full transcript of the court testimony. So I was able to read, the officers telling their version of the story. Which, yeah, they were weirded out for sure.
And it's interesting. What do you think of Richard's explanation for why he gave up? I mean, like you said, this could end it very differently. We mentioned Bill Cooper. Bill Cooper died in a cop standoff. And, you know, conspiracy theorists, they can love Bill Cooper all they want. He shot a cop that really did nothing wrong in that instance. And that cop had like kids and a wife, as far as I understand, and he just murdered him. And Richard didn't do that. And apparently he says it was because of, you know, oh, what would Cheryl think, the country singer? But what do you think it was? Do you think that's part of it, or do you think there was more going on there?
I don't know. Yeah. So Richard told me that he thought of this country music singer, and that's why he surrendered, because he still thought that there might be some chance that they would hit it off. I don't know. I guess I think that I believe him. One thing I found about Richard is he wasn't really a liar, you know. He definitely would see things in a different way. But like when he was telling me about this raid on the Bohemian Grove, I was like, I don't know, maybe this guy is just making this up. But in reading like the court testimony and everything, the story that Richard told me was true. It just was seen from a different perspective from him. So if he told me stuff, I would generally believe it. So I think that maybe thinking this country music singer was something that he kind of grasped on as a reason that he should live and not die.
Now, this brings us around to he ends up in court. He basically says, I'm done with this country. You know, he thinks at first that the jurors are going to side with him. Doesn't turn out that way. And he's just sort of feels betrayed by the United States, right? And what I find interesting through all of this, and you mentioned it earlier, is Alex Jones doesn't come to his defense. Pretty little Alex Jones is building his little InfoWars empire. And I find it really sad in a way because it seems like all Richard ever wanted was, you know, media attention, some level of fame, or, you know, for people to stand by him. And I don't think he realized at that point in time that Alex Jones, at least to me, and I know this is getting opinionated here, editorialist.
Yeah.
I think Alex Jones has had a lot of opportunities that people like McCaslin haven't had. I mean, Alex Jones has been promoted by the media. He's been on Piers Morgan. You know, he's been given that media coverage. He's been given access. And Alex Jones wasn't there for this guy that believed in him.
Yeah, he's a millionaire. He's made all of this money off of doing this provocative type of stuff, you know, and getting attention by jumping up and down and screaming. And he makes a lot of money selling these sort of sham snake oil products on his website. So he has a lot to gain from being Alex Jones because he's made so much money doing it and gotten so much attention, which he loves. I mean, more than anything, is getting this negative attention.
But then when someone actually acts on what he is saying, oh, that's not my fault. I didn't do anything wrong. Right. I didn't say to do that.
And he's done that. Richard is not the only case. There's been cases of other people. And, you know, it's funny because I never hear about someone who has gone completely off the rails because they listen to too much Rachel Maddow or Anderson Cooper. It's always someone who loads up a gun and, you know, has a gunfight with police or something because of Alex Jones over and over again.
I'm based out of Pittsburgh, and there was a police officer that got shot here by like some teenager. And it turns out that kid was a big Alex Jones listener. I'm blanking on his name. But I'm assuming a lot of the Sandy Hook parents getting harassed, that's in part because of people like Alex Jones.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there again, just like the Bohemian Grove thing, there's been times where one of these Sandy Hook parents, Lenny Polzer, decided he would sort of fight back against a conspiracy theory. And Alex Jones at one point, he like gave his address on his show. So he not only encourages these people, but he helps them.
So I realize we can't get into every aspect of the book. Eventually, Richard is released from prison, and he has this inheritance. Doesn't he get released on, I think, sort of some odd technicality? Let's start from there. What happens after he gets out of prison?
He gets out of prison and he is on parole for a couple of years in Redwood City, California. And then as soon as his parole is up, like the next day after his parole is up, he embarks on this 48 state tour where he does peaceful protests under a new superhero persona that he calls Thought Crime. So he just shows up in each state and picks a city and does a protest, peaceful protest in front of you know, a famous landmark or sometimes a spot that would have a connection to a conspiracy theory. So when he's done with this epic journey across America, he moves to Las Vegas. He decides that's where he wants to live. He lives there a little bit, and then using his inheritance, he buys a home in a weird little desert town called Pahrump in Nevada, very close to the California border. And Pahrump, this has some characters in it. So it was kind of made sense that he would move there. And that's where he, again, really had trouble finding something that was working for him. He couldn't find a job, but he had this creative idea that he would make these videos. You mentioned one of the videos earlier, where he, you know, made a new Phantom Patriot costume and had these kind of fantasy superhero adventures. And they're very interesting videos.
And you are in one of them. You were in episode two, which is still up on YouTube, where I forget what it's called, The Assault on Area 51.
Yes,
you're in that, and also the evil supervillain that...
Illuminous.
Illuminous, yes, yeah. Tell us about that experience and what it was all about.
So, you know, this happened in 2015, and I knew that I was trying to wrap the book up at that point. As it turned out, it was not time to wrap it up, but I thought it might be. So I contacted Richard and I said, I want to do a round of interviews with you, and I want to see where you live. So I'm going to come down to Pahrump, and other than the interviews, I'm glad to do anything that you want to do. Just tell me what you want. And I thought, you know, maybe we'll go to a comics bookstore, maybe we'll cruise around Pahrump. But instead, he tells me he wants me to co-star in this action, you know, show. And I was like, okay, I don't have any acting experience or anything, but if that's what you want to do, I'm down. Let's do it. So, you know, I dressed up like a superhero. I pretty badly injured my leg because he wanted me to do my own stunt. And one of those stunts was driving an ATV like down this dirt hill, and I crashed the ATV and like, you know, hurt my leg. So it was a pretty grueling experience, actually. But I did get to see his home, which was very interesting. He'd built like his own superhero headquarters in this large, like garage-like building on his property. You know, where he had all of his costumes on display, and he had like a meeting table, and you know, all of his protest signs were hanging on the walls. So I met him on his home turf there, and yeah, that was the last time that I saw him.
You know, I want to comment on some of these creative endeavors he's done. I know that it would be considered outsider art, like the comic books he did and the retro cinema, but you know, I saw like a lot of extremely untapped potential in this guy looking at his artwork, even the retro cinema thing. Yeah, it's cornball and all, but you can tell he's basing it off like Commander USA's groovy movies, and something like there's this bursting sense of creativity, and he does it on a shoestring budget. I mean, this was I really think he was a talented person.
Yeah. And I hope that this book might stimulate some interest and that he might finally develop a sort of cult following for his artwork and his videos. Because they're definitely unique. Like you said, they're fun, you know. They're a little bit campy, like the old Batman show or something sometimes. They're definitely have some pretty wild curveballs in some of them, but it's interesting. He was a creative individual, you know, and he was talented. I mean, the costumes that he made were pretty cool, and I like his artwork. There's something a little bit weird about his artwork, but that's kind of why I like it. So he did have these creative talents. And I wish, like you say, he could have developed that into something.
Well, again, I think it goes back to, I don't think he had the connections of like a lot of other people do. I mean, this is something I wanted to get into with you before we wrap up. I just had two or more, three more things I wanted to get into if you have the time. The first is another person who seems very well connected. He does international tours, doing 9-hour lectures, is David Icke, who started out as a BBC soccer announcer, announces himself as the son of the Godhead on the Wogan show, and then starts becoming Mr. Conspiracy Guy and telling people that the Royals are 6 foot, 7 foot tall, 12 foot tall reptilian shapeshifters. And apparently Richard fell under the sway of the David Icke spell. Who is David Icke for my listeners that don't know? Did I give a good enough explanation?
Yeah, I mean, you could probably talk 9 hours about the guy, but yeah, that's a good description. So, you know, when Richard got out of prison, he felt betrayed by Alex Jones, you know, by a lot of people. As you mentioned, you know, the jury didn't side with him like he thought. I think he felt this very bitterly betrayed by everyone, almost, except for maybe his friend Lon. But he didn't want to give up on conspiracy theory because, you know, that's just who he is by this point. So he found David Icke to be his new sort of role model, you know, instead of Alex Jones. And yeah, he is just, his theories are way out there. I mean, his most outlandish one, as you mentioned, is the reptilian alien theory, which he's the one who sort of created that. And it grew from there. But he's, you know, it's so surprising this year to see a lot of these people that I wrote about in the book back in the news. So David Icke had a video that was viewed a lot with a British media group. I forget what they're called. But in this video, he's talking about how 5G internet is the cause of the coronavirus. And it goes on and on about this. And this video went viral, and it was seen millions of times. And I was like, great, just who we need in 2020. David Icke.
It's interesting, too, because people – I know a lot of people that look at David Icke and say, oh, well, you know, he's just like a new age guru. He's not that dangerous. And, you know, all this stuff about him being an anti-Semite, that's not true. I'm like, well – if you read the backs of his books where he has a list of books to read, I mean, he has like David Duke listed in his like bibliographies and whatnot, his recommended reading. And, you know, I think he uses that whole, oh, I'm just a new age spiritual guy to cover for the fact that he's this whacked out right wing, you know, authoritarian, I would say, as Alex Jones is.
Yeah, he's just so bizarre. Like, just watching him talk, I don't understand, like, how people can take him seriously and sit through 9-hour lectures and read his 600-page books, you know? So, but he was very influential on Richard. In fact, and this was just something hard to understand, Richard was a very hardcore Christian. Until he went to prison. While he was in prison, he converted to be a Jehovah's Witness. But then when he got out of prison and he discovered David Icke, he was so inspired by him that he quit religion entirely and described himself as agnostic or spiritual, but not a Christian. So that's how profound he took David Icke's work. Was that he was willing to give up his religious beliefs.
Now, he also is profoundly influenced by another, well, a conspiracy couple, actually. And
yes.
You make this video with Richard, and it's one of the only times you get to really see him happy, you know, because he just wanted people to be around him and to stand with him. But in this video that he makes, he mentions a couple by the name of Kathy O'Brien and Mark Phillips, and they have a book. It's an underground, I don't know, maybe alternative classic. I would call it pornography for evangelicals. Transformation yeah. of America. What is Transformation of America? And also, how does this tie into his Cheryl Wright obsession?
Yes. I start to shudder just hearing the title of that book, because it's one of the most awful things I've ever read.
Have you ever seen the documentary, The Most Dangerous Game, about her? It's an 8-minute documentary where she's like, at the end of this, we're going to show you the satanic symbol carved in my vagina. And it becomes like an 8-minute cock tease, and they never show you the satanic symbol. But go on.
Kathy O'Brien, for people who are fortunate enough not to have read this book, claims that she was part of a CIA sex slave program, and that she was programmed to service a ridiculous lineup of the world's most powerful men. You know, presidents, senators,
Bob Hope.
Right, Bob Hope. Entertainers, you know, the leader of Venezuela, like
Boxcar Willie.
Right. Yeah. Country. So Richard reads this book and he is just blown away, and he takes everything written in it, literally, you know, because it's presented as a nonfiction book. And I'm sure, you know, Kathy O'Brien, something traumatic happened to her in her life, but it's not the story that she's telling in this book. But, she mentions country music quite a bit. She says that she met some country singers like Barbara Mandrell. I forget the other country singer's name. But she says that they were brainwashed by the same CIA program, and that they were used as sex slaves and drug mules, you know. And so country music is part of her story. Richard reads this and he's like, oh my God, this explains, you know, Shelley Wright. She was part of this program too. That's why she wasn't interested in me and she seemed weird. And then, you know, later Shelley Wright's revealed something that was very hard for her to deal with. Right around the same time that she met Richard, she was very much closeted because she was gay. And, you know, she was terrified because the country music industry, especially at that point, was not known as a haven for LGBT people. So he reads this book and he thinks that that is an explanation for all of this. And he tries to send a message to her in one of his Phantom Patriot videos that he made in Pahrump. I think that was in he did a video called like 2013 report or something like that. And he, you know, has a kind of weird segment that talks about Shelley Wright. So he connected very heavily to this book. And he actually did a protest outside of the Bohemian Club headquarters, which is, in addition to the Grove, the club also has this big clubhouse in downtown San Francisco. So he did a protest in front of there in 2012, and he read a couple of pages in Transformation, because there's a chapter where Kathy O'Brien talks about how she was used as a sex slave in the Bohemian Grove, and that they had this like weird fetish playground set up inside of the Grove where all sorts of perversions going on, and that she had, you know, also overheard some of these plans to take over the world and stuff like that.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that you found the book disturbing, because, okay, my dad used to take me to, like, you know, ancient mysteries and, like, conspiracy cons, because he found that stuff interesting and whatnot. And I thought, oh, I'm a teenager. This is kind of cool, I guess, maybe. I don't know. I'm nerdy back then. Still am. But it was always funny to me, because that book, along with maybe, like, The Illuminati Formula by Fritz Springmeier and all these other books about, like, Project Monarch sex slaves, they were always sold, like, under the table. They were never on display. You'd have to ask for them. And I'm like, this is what paranoid evangelicals read. Like, it's a pure and interesting thing that they try to cover that up by saying, oh, we're just truth-seeking good Christians. But it is disturbing. Like, I laugh at it, but it kind of is disturbing that there's these women that believe they were, like, sex slaves to Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, I mean, it reads like a bad erotica in some parts. Like, she's talking about how Dick Cheney makes women strip naked and then run around his property in Wyoming so he can hunt them down and then...
Well, you know, there was that hunting incident.
Right, yeah. Right, I mean, so maybe that was the inspiration for it, too. But she's very graphic in describing some of these, you know, alleged sexual assaults from Dick Cheney and Gerald Ford and country music singers and her ex-husband, who was a ventriloquist. You know, it's very, very weird stuff.
And now, people may be saying, and you know what, I was going to ask you about how McCaslin's, I mean, he's not with us anymore. But you know what, I think people should read the book, so we'll leave that to them. That'll be, you know, the cliffhanger. Read the book if you want to know how McCaslin's story ends.
Yes.
But I want to ask you, when I looked at this story, I thought to myself, oh, Bohemian Grove raid, this is like 2002. This is all very similar to, the whole Comet ping pong shooter. So maybe you can comment on how this has become like widespread, or maybe it's always been with us and we just didn't have the means to notice it at all times.
Yeah, I think my book evolved a little bit when that happened, because when that raid, people probably remember this, is 2016, an armed gunman went into Comet Ping Pong in D.C. because he believed a conspiracy, and he'd seen this on InfoWars, again, that there's something called Pizzagate, where this cabal of pedophile Democrats was running a sex trafficking ring out of this pizza restaurant. And when I saw this, I was just stunned about how similar it was to Richard's story. The guy was very similar to him. His plan was very similar. He'd been inspired by InfoWars. He did it like Richard did because he thought he was going to be a total hero, you know. He thought he was going to bust into this pizza place and free all of these child sex slaves that were being kept imprisoned in the basement of the building. And when he got there, he found that the building didn't have a basement, and that there was nothing going on there except for making some actual pizza, not like a code word for pizza. So it was just so striking to me how similar those two stories were. And there's been other stories that are lesser known about people who have planned or actually done stuff. There was a story about a couple of guys in Georgia who were going to take a road trip up to Alaska because they were going to try to attack the HAARP facility, which is, a weather study institute in Alaska. But conspiracy theorists have all of these theories about how they're, you know, using the facility for mind control or for weather manipulation, stuff like that.
Yeah, Nick Begich, I think, is the dude that, started the HAARP conspiracies. But yeah, I'm familiar with all that stuff. It's really out there in my view.
So Richard, you know, he's not the only one. There's all these sort of conspiracy commandos who think that they're going to help the world out by attacking or raiding a place. And, you know, a lot of them, again, get motivated by InfoWars or Alex Jones or someone similar like Glenn Beck or something like that. And they're just, I feel bad for some of these guys because I think they have the intention that they're going to do something great and save these suffering people. But they've just been lied to.
You know, that's what I wanted to end on was I emailed you before we did this interview. And I said, You know, for me, the real American Madness isn't even necessarily McCaslin, because on a metaphorical level, in a way, he's right. In a very metaphorical way. If you treat the conspiracy theories as a metaphor, yeah, there's people that get ahead. We live in a very unequal society. We live in a society where some people are born into the right family, into the right connections. You know, Anderson Cooper, he's a Vanderbilt. I'm sure that has helped him greatly, regardless of whether you like Anderson Cooper's work or not. You know, some people get ahead, and others, like McCaslin, don't. Although he himself had the privilege of, you know, a nice inheritance. Yeah. But here's the thing that gets me is these people get roped in by guys like Alex Jones or guys like Steve Bannon. You know, Steve Bannon just got in trouble for that We Build the Wall campaign, ripping off donors. And Steve Bannon can talk all he wants about, I'm anti-elite, blah, blah, blah. You worked for Goldman Sachs, man. And not only that, but Steve Bannon is a dude that was given unprecedented media access. The journalists love him. Why would we be listening to this guy claiming to fight for we the people when really he's a part of the system? He's a benefactor of it. He's a beneficiary. Stephen Miller. You know, I just had Gene Guerrero on to talk about that. These guys claiming to be like for we the people, they're actually the beneficiaries of the system we live under. You know, you see them on TV, you don't see Noam Chomsky.
right. Yeah, they know the power of, you know, spreading lies, misinformation, conspiracy theory. It's something that can be a very powerful weapon. If you look at Trump, he uses this all the time to try to cut down his enemies and get ahead and, you know, cover his own bad behavior.
He's another one. Everyone always tells me he's anti-elite. And I'm like, how much money does he have? It's so bizarre.
Yeah, exactly. So, but these guys know that that's a great narrative and they're really good at it. That's their talent, is that they can fool people who are, you know, angry, afraid, maybe a little bit gullible into thinking that they're on their side and that they're fighting this war and draining the swamp, you know, when they're, of course, huge swamp creatures themselves. So it's a skill that they have to mislead and fool people like that.
I always like to end on a positive note. I don't know if there is a positive note for our descent into American Madness. I'm trying to think of something, but I'm drawing a blank. Any positive note that we can end on? You know what I just thought of? Other than Richard McCaslin, you talk to a lot of people in different conspiracy movements, from the JFK assassination to 9/11 truthers. Who was the person that you came across that you were like, oh, this is a pretty cool person, even if they have a little bit of, you know, maybe some weird beliefs?
I tell a story about a guy in Dallas. His name just slipped away from me, but the police were harassing him over and over again.
Robert Grodin.
Yes, right. I was like, this is completely unfair. They were harassing this guy. I do believe that people have freedom of speech. This guy was exercising it. He had information about the JFK assassination in Dealey Plaza, and they like ticketed him or arrested him over and over again, like 60 times. Finally, a judge was like, hey, you got a case here. Why don't you sue these cops? And so he eventually did, you know. But I thought his work was interesting, and I thought he was being really treated unfairly just because Dallas thought that he was an eyesore or something like that.
You know, that reminds me, too, and I'm sorry. I know I said last question, but the thing that stuck out to me when I was reading American Madness was when I said that like things are unequal and maybe in a way Richard was right. I thought about his trial, right? And there's this talk of, well, he's a threat to the community. And I'm sorry, but I didn't really see him as that much of a threat. I don't think he would have done anything like the raid again. It sounds like he wouldn't have done it again, even though he still believed in these conspiracy theories. And I said to you in my last email to you, you know, a guy like Richard McCaslin, he doesn't have really any family or friends. He gets the book thrown at him. A guy like Robert Durst that famous HBO documentary series, The Jinx.
Right.
He got away with three murders, essentially.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you could comment on that. Do you think there is an inequality that exists in our society that maybe isn't expressed properly through McCaslin, but it's expressed in other ways?
I do. You know, people, they hear the story and they kind of picture Richard as like this guy that's a mass shooter or something that was just looking to kill a bunch of people. And I don't think that that's a fair way to describe him. People say he's a domestic terrorist. That doesn't really ring true with me either. He went into there because he thought that they had imprisoned children that were going to be sacrificed in a satanic ritual. And I really believe that his intent was to help those people and not just to randomly kill people. So, like you said, they really threw the book at him. He was charged with 5 felonies and 2 enhancements. And, you know, they gave him the maximum sentence that they could, which was he was originally supposed to be in prison for 12 years, I think, something like that, 12 years. His sentence got reduced later on because the judge had made some sort of error. And this really affected his life so badly because once he got out of prison, he wanted to try to find a job just to keep himself busy. And of course, if you have 5 felonies on your record, it's a lot harder to do a job search. So I think that, you know, he was guilty of a crime, but I don't think that it was as hyped up as they made it.
And there actually was a bit of a conspiracy against him when he was in prison. Maybe you could just end on that because I found it funny that someone from Bohemian Grove came to see him.
Yeah, so that is a good place to end because, you know, Richard was not wrong about everything. Some things that he talked about, I was like, all right, I get what you're saying. Some things had a grain of truth to him. So he's in prison, and a guy comes to the prison. He says that he's a member of the Secret Service to the prison staff. He gets to interview Richard for a couple of hours. And then they find out that this guy was not a Secret Service person. He was an ex-Secret Service person who was the head of security at the Bohemian Grove. So the Bohemian Grove, like, snuck their guy into prison just so they could interrogate Richard and find out what he knew. So, I mean, that was not a conspiracy theory. It was covered by the Sonoma Press Democrat as a newspaper there, and they uncovered the story and found that this guy had lied so he could get in there.
Well, T, I think that's a great place to leave off on. I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. Folks, check it out. American Madness. This is a book that, you know, you should really be proud of it because I think it connects the dots on a cultural phenomena that's really staring us in the face today. So I want to thank you for writing it and thank you for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you. Yeah, it turned out to be a very timely book with this crazy year that we're having. But thanks for having me on. It was great talking to you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with T. Krulos, author of the fascinating new book, American Madness, The Story of the Phantom Patriot, and how conspiracy theory hijacked American consciousness. It is sitting on the table right next to me as I speak, and let me tell you, it is definitely worth a read. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @viewsparallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. And also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com parallaxviews. Producers credit shoutouts to Emilia, Martin, Mark, Zach, Ted, John, Brace, Gratz, and Mickey. If you'd like to get your own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, join those aforementioned listeners of the program by supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.